It's time for hors d'oeuvre. I'm winding up the hors d'oeuvre part of the Escoffier series, and you might hear a whew, finally part. It's taken a little while, but I feel like it was necessary. So here we are on to the last bit. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 213, Food and Freedom Once a Week for Life. This is, as I said, the last in the hors d'oeuvre series. Now, I was reminded during the, I reminded myself actually, during the Christmas confections episode that the first goal of this show is to make cooking possible and easy. Now, there's certainly more than enough in Escoffier that seems impossible and is very far from easy. There are some types of dishes in the Escoffier that you want to do and some that are nothing but stress. So, this is not to say that hors d'oeuvre is particularly simple, but it is doable. I'm focusing on presenting techniques that are possible in your kitchen and worth doing for the variety of options available from those particular things or from those techniques. Now, last time we discussed brochettes and barquettes and a couple of other things. Today, I want to focus on croquettes. Now, it's funny that Escoffier has croquettes listed, but with two spellings. Now, why the two spellings, I don't know, but my guess is to visually denote the difference of the product. Croquette, C-R-O-Q-U-E-T, and croquette, C-R-O-Q-U-E-T-T-E, are the two choices. The first is made with usually noodles. He calls it farinaceous products. And the second requires a salpicone. We've talked about that, and I'll get back to that. In addition, with mushrooms and a portion of the appropriately flavored sauce to bind. So first, the noodle or farinaceous croquette. Escoffier writes, quote, "The mixture is invariably composed of a farinaceous paste such as fresh noodles, which should be cooked in a boiling salted water, and kept a little firm, then drained and mixed with a good amount of lean ham cut in fine julienne, some reduced sauce, bechamel, and grated cheese. Spread the mixture 3/8 of an inch thick on a buttered tray and allow it to become cold. Mold the mixture into rectangles 2 1/4 by 3 1/4 inches long to 1 1/3 inches wide. Egg and breadcrumb twice, using very fine breadcrumbs so as to give a double thickness of outside crust, and deep fry at the last moment in very hot fat." End quote. So, there's a couple things there. It's simple enough, but notice the cook needs to know or guess a few things. Some reduced sauce bechamel. How much? Some grated cheese. What kind and how much? Both are great questions, and the answer changes the success or fail of the dish. Since this is a deep-fried thing, a thicker rather than thinner sauce is a better choice, and less is better than more. As to cheese, feta and double cream brie cheese are not the same. Cheddar or Swiss or Gruyere or Colby or Monterey Jack mostly behave the same when mixed into hot things. Feta will not melt, really, and brie was much too soft, even at room temperature, to hold the shape. The correct and frustrating answer is add enough cheese to give a background flavor, but not too much cheese, so that the frying of the croquette makes the cheese melt and leak out of the crumb crust. Completely practical and completely frustrating. Notice Escoffier does not use ratios of stuff to product in the first croquette. The key is to have enough flavor, but but not so much the noodle won't hold it. So the flavor here is coming from that ham and then the cheese. You can add other stuff. The trick is maybe taking out some ham and replacing it with some other stuff, chopped olives or chopped cooked onions or something, but you got to keep whatever the ratio is that we're going for somewhat the same. That crispy breading outside has some structure to it, but it doesn't have a lot of structure to it. So without specific directions, do this and this and this and this, it can be a little frustrating. So the key guideline in the thing like that is less would be better than too much, because then too much is going to make it all fall apart. And when it falls apart in your fryer, there ain't no getting it. Don't reach in. Now, one of the things that Escoffier writes for lots of things, particularly or including the croquettes, is to garnish with fried parsley. It's nice. It doesn't have a lot of flavor, but it's nice. Fried spinach and fried sage leaves, you know what? They're nice too. So what? Better, in my opinion, is a sauce. With pasta, remember, the first croquette is a noodle. Tomato sauce comes to mind, but so does a cheese sauce, especially a cheese sauce with the same cheese inside. Think of it as a fried mac and cheese bite, just pureed version. A little bit of innovation from the ingredients applied in a new way. For croquettes, C-R-O-Q-U-E-T-T-E-S, Escoffier is more specific about ingredients and portions. He writes, quote, "The portion of the ingredients used in croquette mixtures should be carefully balanced by regulating the ratios of the subsidiary ingredients, which are usually mushrooms, flap mushrooms, ham, tongue, or truffle, to that of the principal ingredient, which can be poultry, game, fish, or shellfish. It is the principal ingredient, of course, which determines the name of the croquette. The proportions are established in the following manner. Half of the total mixture should be composed of the principal ingredient. A quarter should be mushrooms or flap mushrooms. 1/6 should be ham or tongue, and 1/12 truffle. So, for example, for 500 grams of salpicone of poultry or game, the quantity of the subsidiary ingredients would be 9 ounces, 250 grams of mushrooms, 170 grams or 5.5 ounces of ham or tongue, and 85 grams or 3 ounces of truffle. Likewise, all cut in salpicone." End quote. First off, that's a whole lot of truffle. And of course, half a kilo is a pretty big portion. So no one's really going to be making a pound and a half of salpicone. And so now we are at, what the heck is the salpicone? All right, let's go back to that. Real quick, this isn't too hard. I'm not flipping pages. You can hear the la-la-la-la-la-la. Looking. Here we go. All right. A salpicone can be made simple or compound. And the first stage in the preparation of a salpicone consists of cutting the items of which it is to be composed into small, even-shaped 1/8-inch dice. Sorry, 1/5. Very small. 1/5-inch dice. The next stage in the preparation of a salpicone is the combination of these items in accordance with the requirements of their own particular name. And so he goes into, there's a various kinds of salpicone uses, and the croquette would be one of them. So you're already thinking, my gosh, I had no idea I needed a master's degree just to make a freaking appetizer. Well, it's not really quite all that bad. The ratio part is relevant because of the thing holding together and the primary flavor being the thing that it is. So a salpicone of chicken gets balanced with mushrooms and ham and truffles. And then here's the thing. It's all bound together by a well-reduced sauce, also in the flavor of the thing. So if we're doing a chicken croquette, We have this very small, even dice of chicken with our subsidiary flavoring ingredients. A well thickened. Here we are. What in the heck does that mean? Well, you can either thicken with the roux product and let that cook way down, or make your stock and cook it way, way, way down, and it becomes glossy and thick. In the process of doing that, what remains in the stock is the gelatin. The gelatin doesn't really present its power in a hot state, but it certainly does in a cold state. So think Jell-O. When you make Jell-O in the bowl, who cares? It's like big deal. When you refrigerate it, oh, now we have something. So this well-thickened sauce, either or in part with reduction and a thickening agent, just enough to bind all of those elements in the salpicone together, then place it in a pan, cut it into shapes, bread it, and fry it. Now, here's the thing. Now, they sound fabulous. What a great way to eat this fried stuff. And croquettes, as Escoffier describes them, well, even reading through that, it sounds like a really big challenge. And the main reason is they are, especially the foie gras croquette. It's like deep frying butter. Now, I said at the top of this that this is about doing what is at least most likely certain to work. It is possible to do these croquettes, but for ease and lack of frustration, do them if you wish. I'm not telling you not to, but I think I would probably steer away from them and go into something else. And the something else is a potato croquette. Now, there is, I'm looking for another one, it's a kind of potato called Pommes de Terre Bernie. No, not him. A different Bernie. Pommes de Terre Bernie is the croquette recipe I'm going to read with, guess what? Truffles. No way. That Bernie is going to do truffles, at least not for you. He'll do it for him. Trim the potatoes to the size of large. So, croquette de pomme de terre, croquette potatoes. Cut the potatoes into pieces and cook them quickly in salted water, keeping them slightly firm. Drain, dry them in the oven, and pass them through a sieve or a food mill like we talked about in the mashed potato episode. Replace to the pan and add 3.5 ounces of butter for every kilo. So it's 100 grams of butter for every 1,000 grams of potato. That's far less than we used in mashed potatoes. Season with salt and pepper, grated nutmeg, mix well on the stove to get the rest of the water out. Now, once this, let this cool down a little bit, we're going to add into that 4 egg yolks and 1 whole egg. Now, the egg white is, well, it looks like mostly water, but that protein is going to help hold everything together. And the egg yolk does have some thickening properties when it cooks, but mostly it's an emulsion thing, plus a flavor thing and texture thing. With this finished croquette mix, we can do just like those other croquettes. We can add chicken, which doesn't need to be salpicone, and ham and truffles and mushrooms and whatever else we want to have. Bearing in mind that there is some limit to how much stuff any particular portion of croquette is going to hold. Now, think about making a croquette kind of like a fried mozzarella stick. Maybe a little bit shorter, a little bit fatter, but that's kind of the same idea. Oh, better yet, maybe think like a wine cork. So you can mix your cheese in there. Now, the things inside as garnish do need to be small. If you're using mushrooms, they need to be cooked. Everything that's inside a croquette that could be cooked needs to be cooked. We need the water out, which helps the croquette not fall apart. It also enhances and maximizes flavor. So we're not putting raw chicken into a potato croquette. We're putting This is a great way. Croquettes are a fantastic way to use up leftovers. If you have leftovers, especially now, if you make mashed potatoes, don't make them too fat, make them lean, and then you can use them as croquette mixture. There's a lot of other things that can happen with that. Just don't do like we did in episode 212. With a potato croquette, it seems to me this is also an excellent spot for a sauce. Now, I think a cheese sauce is really, really good. Depending on what you put into that croquette, maybe there's lots of herbs in there, lots of sage and rosemary. A nice herbed brown butter would be a really nice accompaniment to those croquettes. Or spiced, depending on what is inside. Maybe you put jalapenos and caramelized onions and black olives. So like a cumin coriander brown butter might be a nice garnish for a croquette like that. Now, this is coming on the spot, coming up with these ideas. And I know some people don't want to think about compatibility and contrast. They want to follow the recipe. What do the words on the page say? And I get it. I really, truly do. Whenever I'm trying a new to-me recipe, I follow the procedure, unless I know the procedure is wrong. And that usually there is worth, I do it that way the first time to find out where the mistakes are or find out how I can improve it. It's not always mistakes, but there's ways that I can make it better for what it is I want to achieve. So I get following the rules. Pushing yourself a bit out of your comfort zone, especially with accompaniments like sauces, is a good way to learn about what goes well together or what contrasts well together. Now, with Thanksgiving approaching, maybe turkey croquettes with leftover gravy is something for Thanksgiving Friday. But really, Thanksgiving Friday is really meant for post-turkey Thanksgiving pizza. Duh, of course. Yes. There's a page for that. If you don't have a deep fryer, croquettes, both kinds of spellings, can be pan-fried, but with some careful attention paid, the bottom of the pan will be hotter than the oil inside, and that risks burning on the contact spot any portions that are touching the pan. Frequent rolling or turning of the croquette is important, as is a place ready for those finished croquettes. Now, a word about implementation, implements. I have been fairly plain on more than a few occasions that I absolutely detest tongs, and this would be one of those places that I absolutely detest tongs. If you have, they call them a fish spatula, its proper name is a Peltex, nobody cares, they're slotted. They're helpful because they have the slots, and as you put the little Peltex fish spatula under the thing to be flipped, the fat stays behind, so you risk being burned and picks the thing up. That's good. Any kind of even those kitchen tuning forks, kitchen carving forks, large tablespoons, large soup spoons. There's a whole array of implements that will work. Offset spatulas, the little mini-sized pastry ones. There are scores of things that will work much better than tongs, which only really just, once you go through all the work of frying this croquette and have this gorgeous, beautiful, golden brown exterior, you take in the tongs and all that it does is cracks the outside. It's angering. So don't use tongs. Usually, I have a small wire rack and a quarter sheet pan set up for receiving things that are being fried. Or you can take, cut a pastry bag, no wrong word, a produce bag, cut the bottom off and split the sides, and I have two pieces of plastic. Put some paper towel on top of the plastic, and then put your croquettes on the paper towel. The paper towel will absorb the fat. The plastic will keep the fat off of your counter, so cleanup is a breeze. I do the paper towel on the plastic thing when I do bacon. I bake bacon on a full and, well, a half sheet pan with a rack. It shrinks, but it stays nice and flat. It's very handy. Take the bacon off of that, put it on the paper towel, save the fat, of course. And then most of the fat I save for me for cooking for the rest of the week on the eggs or whatever it is I'm making. And whatever's on the pan, I will scrape off for the Sunday dinner for the dogs because, well, why not? The doggies like it. Even the cats like bacon fat, but I don't give that to them in their food. I want to address a rarely used, even in Escoffier's time, appetizer called, pretty sure, cannelloni. Sounds like, looks like cannelloni. They are made with small pieces of puff pastry, maybe 4 inches long and 3/4 of an inch wide. And then on that raw, you spread a small layer of forcemeat. What's that? Spread real thin. Then roll this whole thing up so it looks like a little mini roulade. Then bake the whole thing on a mini Swiss roll. Then bake them all and then eat them like that. A forcemeat is the inelegant explanation is you're forcing fat into the meat. Most modern words to describe that are called mousse. Probably mean mousseline, but it's something that you make in a food processor. Say you have chicken breast, you're going to puree that till it's a smooth paste in your food processor. Then add an egg white, depending on how much you've got. I don't remember what the ratio of meat to egg white to cream is. And then once the egg white is incorporated into the meat, then you pulse in some heavy cream. And when you poach this stuff, usually it's poached in the form of a quenelle. Quenelle looks like an egg. It's tender because it's pureed. You've added flavor to it in the form of, guess what, truffles. Mushrooms, could be pistachios, could be who knows what. But that's kind of pretty as a garnish, either for a soup or it's an appetizer all by itself. You could even use, if you're a little bit more rustic and happen to have homemade sausage hanging around, you could spread some of your sausage onto this piece of puff pastry, roll it up, bake it, and eat that. So to make these cannellones, the first thing you need is puff pastry. Well, either make it or buy it, and then you need forcemeat. So it's like, all right, well, this is a lot of work. Not good work if you can do it, but what if we change everything about this but keep the idea? Instead of puff pastry, what if you used a nice slice of cold smoked salmon? Instead of force meat, what if we put on there some chive and caper cream cheese? Instead of baking it, serve it cold with a small salad of really nicely small, a salpicone salad of red onions and cucumbers, and just a little touch of dill. Now, that would be a really nice little appetizer inspired by something that's more troublesome, maybe, depending, it's a judgment. Or maybe take a piece of mortadella or prosciutto, spread onto that something that makes sense to you. Tapenade, black olive tapenade would be good on the mortadella. It needs something. I can't think of it. It needs a crunch is what it needs. Like a little julienne red onion salad would be nice with that. So there's other ways to go, other ideas to take from this that aren't the thing at all, but we can be inspired by the outcome and say, oh, I can do something else with that. When this hors d'oeuvre series first started, I mentioned that Escoffier referred to in his introduction zakuski, the Russian kind of appetizers. He made a few references to them, and in different parts of the chapter, there are portions which are the Russian versions of, or his version of the Russian name for the thing. Now, One of the things that shows up near the end of the hors d'oeuvre chapter are pierogies. Now, he makes them needlessly hard, in my opinion, but they are an excellent idea for hot appetizers. Now, pierogies will be another show, but that's something to think about. Another idea branching off of this is to cook and cool. Another idea of his is potatoes. Cook and cool very small potatoes. Say, you know, you sometimes see them, I hate the word gourmet potatoes, but they're a little like fingerling or a little round, red and blue and white new potatoes, like ping pong ball or golf ball sized. Ping pong is probably better. Cook and cool those. Cut off the top, like maybe the top third quarter. Scoop out the inside. Yeah, it's kind of fussy. Take that out. Fill them with a salpicone mixture of mushrooms and anything that's left over in the fridge. You can even add some of that potato back inside. And it doesn't have to be salpicone 1/5 of an inch. It can be just small dice. No one's going to come check. Fill them. Replace the top. Then bake them until they're hot inside. Now, if you have one of those little teeny muffin tins, you could bake them in that so they kind of don't fall over. You could cut the bottom off a little wee bit so that they stand up when they're served. But that's another kind of hot app that would be fun. Bacon and blue cheese with a little bit of breadcrumbs and some of the potato added back. that would be good. There are a few last items in the chapter, and one more of them resembles the croquette, but it's cut into different shapes after it's made. So the whole idea is you have salpicone and mushrooms and truffles and ham and well-reduced stock. Put that in a pan like the first croquette with noodles. Let it cool. Cut them into different shapes, and the shapes are the things that give it the name. Bread them and deep fry. It just reads like pure frustration to me. Now, I mentioned a minute ago, I'm not telling you to avoid the adventure if you seek it, but a caution to you: if stress and risk of failure is more than you prefer, especially with holidays coming up and people showing up at any minute, avoid making them when time and need are important. Save them for, you know, February 29th. It might be worth doing, just maybe not, you know, when stress is high. The last thing I want to focus on in this episode is procedure for making pate au choux. Now, that shows up in a variety of places. We talked about that a little bit last week for it's also called choux paste, or it's the exact same dough used for cream puffs and profiteroles and long johns and cougères, which is the pastry with some cheese added to it, and they're piped really small, so they look kind of like croutons that go on soup. And man, oh man, those things are good. Before I get into that, let's take a moment out for words from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
I'll put a recipe on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/214 for pate au choux or choux paste. Choux is C-H-O-U-X, and pate au choux, I think it means little cabbages, because when you make the small profiteroles, they look kind of like cabbages. You may have to sort of open your mind a little bit to abstract art to fully see that, but it's what they meant. But I want to go through the process a little bit, even though the recipe will be there. This isn't particularly hard cooking, but it can possibly be a little bit of a frustration. And if we can avoid a frustration, then we certainly should do that. So, A good-sized recipe starts with 8.5 ounces of milk, 1/2 teaspoon of sugar, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 4 ounces of butter, whole, not melted, 5.5 ounces of all-purpose flour, and 5 eggs. Now, the procedure is pretty simple. Keep in mind that since we have milk here, we're going to be boiling milk. Milk has enzymes and it's going to overflow, so make sure you're staying at the stove. You can use water. In fact, there's a lot of room to wiggle in here. Mostly any liquid you could use. You could probably use orange juice, although I think your end use for puffs is probably very restricted. You could use walnut oil, hazelnut oil, some seed oil that I highly recommend you do not use. You could use lard, duck fat, beef fat, bacon fat. Anything that's in the fat area is going to work. You can't sub out eggs. You need eggs. But there's a lot of ways to wiggle here once you get this whole thing down. The most common substitute you would have for milk would be water. The key difference here is that milk will brown, because milk has protein, milk's going to brown in the oven to a higher degree than a water-based pot of choux is going to brown. I think flavor's a wash. I don't think you're going to get much in the way of flavor once this thing is caramelized. But all things being equal, there isn't much else of a difference between milk and water other than the cost of the ingredients. So put the milk, the salt, the sugar, and the butter into a pan. Bring that to a boil. Your utensils, you're going to need, if you have it, a stand mixer or a handheld mixer. You will definitely need a very sturdy wooden spoon, a pot big enough to hold all of this stuff so you can work in, because we're going to be stirring. So you want to have a little bit of height to the edges, maybe like a 2-quart saucepan perhaps. Bring all of those things together, milk, salt, sugar, butter. Bring it to a boil. Dump in the flour all at one time. Turn the heat to low, not off, and stir. Start slowly because you're going to be splashing hot liquid. Stir that mix together so that the flour is incorporated into all of that liquid and starts to come together. And it will come together pretty quickly. Within 15 to 30 seconds, you're going to have a ball of stuff on the end of your wooden spoon. And that's okay. It's exactly what we want. If you look at this thing, you see this glob of wallpaper paste. Well done. You're on the right path. Take that ball of dough, put that into the bowl of your stand mixer. Use your rubber spatula. Use rubber spatula, scrape all that out into the bowl. Put the paddle in the bowl and turn it on to speed 1. Right now that thing is 212-ish or so degrees, and that's too hot to add eggs. Eggs start to cook at 145. If we add eggs to a dough that's too hot for them, what we want to get from the eggs, which is their elasticity, their flavor, and their stretchiness when they cook, we're not going to get that. We've made scrambled eggs inside of dough, and now we've made garbage. Don't make garbage. With the paddle on, put your hand carefully on the outside of the bowl. If it feels cool to the touch, then it's cool enough to add eggs. Now, add your eggs 1 at a time. This is very important. The first addition of eggs you have is going to make your dough, which is just spinning nicely in the bottom of the bowl, it's going to make it look like it's ruined. It's going to split. And it's going to... You can say, oh no, this is a big mess. I completely ruined this. What happened in the bowl is completely expected and, as it happens, necessary. As the dough is being mixed and the egg is being incorporated, it will start to come back together to be a homogeneous, viscous thing. Dough. We want that. Now, when it is all smooth and the egg is completely incorporated, add the next 1. Same thing is going to happen, but to a slightly little less of a degree. Since it's already split once, it's got some egg in there, it'll do it again, but less. Make sure that it's completely incorporated. We don't need speed here. This isn't a race. We need time. Time on the clock to just let that thing happen. Speed one or two is fine. Third egg, same thing. Mixed to incorporated. Fourth egg, fifth egg. Once that's fully incorporated, take your butter spatula, turn the mixer off, scrape down the bowl, make sure that all the stuff on the side of the bowl is incorporated into your dough, your pate choux, your choux paste, and you're good to go. If you don't have a stand mixer, but you have a handheld mixer, the same principles apply. Put it in, you can even do it in the saucepan you were working in, but stir with the handheld mixer on low speed long enough for the steam and the heat to come out of the dough. Check it with your hand carefully, don't burn, to make sure that the pan is cool enough for you to touch. If it's cool enough to touch, it's cool enough to add the eggs. And then same thing, one at a time, making sure that it is completely incorporated and comes back to its smooth, and it's going to have a nice sheen to it and a good luster to it, and make sure that it comes back to that. Now, if you don't have a stand mixer or a handheld mixer, it is possible to mix pate choux in the pot in which you made it with that very stiff wooden spoon. Now, you will need one more thing that you can't get if you don't have it. And that's some really serious shoulder and forearm muscles, because this is going to take some work. It's possible to do, but it's going to give you a workout. Same thing applies. Stir the dough until it's cool. Eggs one at a time. It's going to take longer by hand for that egg to mix into the dough, but it will work. And make sure at the end you use your rubber spatula to get the sides of the bowl and as much of the bottom as you can so that all of the dough is incorporated into your pate choux. Once all the eggs are in, congratulations, you've made pate choux. Now, what do we do with it? Put into a piping bag and then pipe to your desired shapes and sizes. Well, what are they? How do I know what my shapes and sizes are? Well, that's simple. If you're making eclairs, I'm going with 3 inches long or 5 inches long, depends how much eclair you want, depends how much pastry cream you've made. Profiteroles, and now there's a bunch of YouTube videos that will show you how to pipe this, and this is really a better to see than to hear kind of a thing. One tip I will give you, if you're using those baking sheets, the paper ones, but possibly even for the silicone mats, on the sheet pan itself, put a couple of in each corner, just a little dab of the pate choux dough on the pan, then put the paper or the silicone mat on top of it and press down. That dough is going to hold that baking sheet in place, because this dough is a really stiff dough. It's a very sticky dough. And when you get it onto the baking paper, it tends to be a little bit less cooperative than the silicone mats. And you start to try to pipe it into a round. You're going to make some profiteroles. Sometimes the paper wants to follow the dough, and then it just... Well, that could be frustrating. So there's a variety of, I know there are YouTube videos that show you how to make the most of your piping skills to make eclairs, cream puffs, profiteroles. There's even a way to turn these things into a donut with a really big star tip. Yeah, donuts. So the baking part. Now, one of the things that's really important about a profiterole or an eclair or a cream puff is when this thing gets baked, we've worked hard to get to this point. What we want to have happen is the heat is going to turn the water. Water is either the milk or the water, and the egg yolks are a high degree of water. We turn that into steam. The flour is going to hold that steam and make the thing expand. Now, at some point, it will split and the steam will come out, but you have this big cavity. And there's nothing inside, which is the goal. We want this to be a big, hollow thing. if it's not baked and dried enough. Those are two separate issues. Baking is that 400 or so degrees to get that first rise, depending on a couple of things. How many are on the pan, how hot your oven is, how your oven is set, how humid it is, whether it's January or July. The baking time and the drying out time will take longer. The drying out part is we want to create mostly a shell. Unbaked or underbaked shoe paste has kind of a eggy, custardy texture to it, and it doesn't have an eggy, custardy flavor to it. It tastes like eggy flour. It's not really very attractive. So let them dry. Let them dry in the oven. So this is, again, more hunting on the Dr. YouTubes. Chef YouTube. Bake at about 400, 425, and then lower the temperature to 325, 300 to dry them out. You may have to crack the top of the oven a little bit to get the rest of the moisture out of the oven, but the whole goal is to get this very hollow, dry, nice, crunchy thing, and then as a canapé filling, you can cut them apart completely. Take the top off, bisect them, the hemisphere, put your filling in there. So you've made a chicken liver mousseline or cream cheese based things are good. Chicken liver mousse things are good. We want to put into this vessel something that isn't obviously wet. So we wouldn't put pasta salad in there because it's going to sog out the bottom of the little cream puff, little profiterole. Now, I'm going to confound this entirely in just a second. So something that's going to sit on a pan or a plate or a passing dish for more than a few minutes, something that doesn't have a whole lot of moisture so that when the guest gets it, it's dry and crispy and crunchy and it's exactly what it's supposed to be. I said profiterole, and that's a really fun thing. It's ice cream. So, but now here's the thing. We're not going to be walking around the dining room with profiteroles for 20 minutes saying, profiterole, profiterole. This is a plate and go and serve kind of thing. So in the time it takes to make it and serve it and the person to eat it, the crunch remains. Eclairs, Long Johns, I'm sure there's other regionalisms I'm not getting. Same idea. You want that stuff really, really dry and you're going to put your pastry cream aside. Pastry cream is wet. So, If you're making donuts for sale, you're making Long Johns every day. If you're making donuts for dessert, you're filling those Long Johns maybe before you sit down to dinner, certainly not at noon for 7 o'clock dinner. That would be silly. Don't do that. Storing your thing. I'm interrupting myself. In the winter months, in most places, the humidity is pretty low. So I would store them in something that is sealable anyway, just to protect them. But in the summertime, definitely store them in something that can be sealed, like a cake container, you know, the kind that snaps with the lid on top, you can carry it. Those do a pretty good job of keeping stuff out and stuff in. And so that would be a good way to store your little puffs until you're going to use them. Make them today for tomorrow. Possibly today for 2 days out at the most. Now, it is possible if they get a little soggy, you can refresh them in the oven, 200 or 250 degrees for a few minutes just to get the water out of them again. We'll bring back their crunch. We don't want to get necessarily more color on them, but we want to get them crispy and crunchy again. I have successfully made gluten-free pot of choux. Now, I'm pretty sure I go through lots of gluten-free flours here. I'm pretty sure I used the Trader Joe's version of gluten-free flour mix. Now, I don't know what the ratios are because they don't say, but the key part about the Trader Joe's gluten-free flour mix is it does not contain xanthan gum. Now, all gluten-free flours thicken at different rates, so if you're using something else, the ratios might not be exactly the same. That's something that you're going to have to play with. And not all mixes are the same. The reason we don't care at all for the mouthfeel and the finished product that xanthan gum creates. So that's why I'm not using it. There are some other ones out there that don't have xanthan gum in them. You can find a couple of really spectacular gluten-free sites that have recipes for mix you can make with a variety of different kinds of flours, and there are 40 different kinds of flours you can use, but some are more preferred than others. But it is possible if that's something that you want or you need to have. All right. Well, I guess the main thing really, even in the rest of Escoffier's book, from the beginning to the end, but right now, even like on page one, at the very beginning of the series, one of the things I pointed out, and it's easy to forget, is that he gives the cook permission to innovate and change. Because he wrote it down 200 years ago or something, doesn't mean it can't be altered. We can change. We can adjust to our needs, our wants, our preferences, and our abilities. So take some of these things as inspiration for a new thing. Take that puff pastry thing, the cannelloni, and make something else. Take the idea, you can call it whatever you want. Call it Prosciutto Susie. I know it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. But find way. I'm encouraging you to find ways to see other opportunities. And I understand sometimes that's a challenge, and that's okay. It's even the most seasoned cooks still challenge them, question themselves, and that's all right. All right, that's going to do it. As I said, I will have a link to the recipe for the pot au choux on the show notes page, and I'm also going to add a link to my cookbook, Cooking for Comfort, which coincidentally doesn't have a single recipe that uses pot au choux, but I will put that on the show notes page as well. I want to thank you for being here and listening to all these hors d'oeuvre episodes. The next one is going to be eggs. Oh, man, that's fun. A cookery is a blast. I appreciate you being here. And thank you to my Patreon supporters. There is no chef table portion for this episode, but not today. As of me speaking into the computer, my goal is this week to get a short video of making pot au choux up on the Patreon for the Patreon members. And there's, if you look up the recipe, there you may find dozens of different versions, but fundamentally they're all the same: liquid fat and eggs, with liquid fat, eggs and flour, with seasonings and flavorings. All right, next week, I don't usually tip my hand to the guest, but oh my goodness, next week is a very powerful and emotional show. Well, to me, because I'm talking to a survivor of cancer who has an interesting story to tell about her experience and how she managed to get through it better than most with and without food. Yeah, that sounds like a good tease. All right, have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.